Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Well, today we are talking to Gary Mex Glazner. He's the director of the Bowery Poetry Club in New York. He's the director of the Alzheimer's Poetry Project. He is, of course, himself a poet, and he's the author of How to Make a Living as a Poet and the sequel, How to Make a Life as a Poet. Yeah. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi. Welcome, Santa Fe, to the radio inside of my head at this point. Great headphones.
Yes, great headphones indeed. And you will be performing tonight at the Center for Contemporary Arts here in Santa Fe on Old Pecos Trail at 7 o'clock along with Adobe Gillis as part of the Vox Performa series. And it's you used to live in Santa Fe. It's wonderful to have you back.
Yeah, and we still have a home here and still connected to the state. We have my relatives are ranchers down in Estancia.
So we thought that this would be a wonderful opportunity to talk about poetry and all sorts of different poetry, not only yours, but the poetry that's inspired you and poetry throughout the ages. And I thought we could start with this silly question. What is a poem?
Well, that's a great question. And doing Poets in the Schools work, which I started in 1990 in California, and I've done it in 7 different states, I've kind of built up a collection of different people's definitions of poetry that I use with the students, because it always comes up of, what they think a poem is and what other people do. So here's a couple of those. I think these are really fun. The first one is Emily Dickinson. She says, "If I feel physically as if the top of my head were taken off, I know that is poetry."
As opposed to a mugging.
Yeah, as opposed, or that then would fit the definition of that. And here's another one by her. She says, "If I read a book and it makes my..." Now, you got to imagine, though. You got to step back for a minute. Emily's in her room by herself, wearing her sort of white ghostish outfit. So she's probably pretty safe in there when her head's getting taken off the top of her head. But here's her other one. I love this one. "If I can read a book and it makes my whole body so cold, no fire can ever warm me, I know that is poetry."
So basically, a deep emotional, visceral reaction.
Yeah, I think that's what she's going for.
But, I mean, movies give you that. Novels give you that.
Yeah, movies, novels give you that. Here's one by Robert Frost. Again, maybe it's along the poetry as slash mugging genre. "Poetry is a way of taking life by the throat." And here's the last one. Well, I think we'll keep coming back to these. We can talk more. Here's another one. This one's by maybe a lesser-known poet, Gilbert Chesterton. He says, "The poets have been mysteriously silent on the subject of cheese."
Can you say more about that?
I guess he was just pointing out there's not a lot of great cheese poems out there. Maybe that's a challenge, audience. That's a challenge to you, Santa Fe listening audience, to write a cheese poem today.
And email it to radiocafe@ksfr.org, and we will read it if you want on the air. What are the earliest poems that we know of?
Well, that's a really interesting question, and it ties in for me as a working poet with the Alzheimer's Poetry Project. And so one of the things that I've been exploring recently, and really through an essay by a poet by the name of Jane Hirschfield, she's a California poet, lives north of San Francisco, and she has a thesis or idea that poetry is the earliest mechanism for memorization. And she bases that on the idea of the Iliad, which we talked about, and Homer's work being initially oral poetry, and was a way for that community or society to remember its stories. And we can also see that, so that goes back, thousands of years, back to pre-writing. But we also can still see that working today with the African griot. And one of the great things about the Bowery Poetry Club is we have a griot in residence. His name is Papa Sousa.
What's a griot?
A griot is the African poet slash storyteller slash historian of their community, and they tell the community's story through this oral work, which is still oral in their tradition, and is essentially the African version of what Homer was doing. And so it tells the village's story, and Papa Sousa, his whole family plays an instrument called the kora, which is sort of a cassava gourd with 21 strings attached to it, and they sing these songs, and it keeps track of the history and keeps track of the knowledge system, really, for the community.
So rather than being, you know, esoteric or effete or marginalized, is utterly central to the memory and history of a community.
Exactly, and that, Mary Charlotte, is exactly Jane Hirschfield's point. It is that it's central to the community and central to life, and she extrapolates from there and says it's central to the way that our brains were constructed originally. And so that poetry, and she feels like there's a resonance through, you know, even in American society now, you have this resonance, this sort of echo of this way of keeping track of knowledge in rhymed, rhythmic material. And they go, they've done research with Homer's works, and they go back, and it's in hexameter, and you can see that that was a way for them to be able to hold that knowledge without being able to write it down.
So originally, the Iliad was full of rhymes?
Yeah.
Because you don't read it that way, obviously, in translation to English.
Exactly. We've lost it, and now you read it as a sort of, you know, it's prose as we read it. But when you go back and look at the original Greek, it's in rhymed rhythmic material.
It's also hard to imagine that a poem that long, 800 pages, is even able to be memorized.
Yeah, and so one of the things you see, and there's also, it's a lovely thing to have the griots because they're still functioning, so you don't have to, like, sort of, you know, guess and look back at old documents and figure out how Greek was translated. You can just go see how they work. And what happens is it does change. You know, when they tell the story, they say that I tell the story every time exactly the same way. It's the village's story. This is how it goes. But it actually, if you record it, it actually changes a little bit and is fluid. And as it gets passed down, it gets changed a little bit too. And so then we see, the Odyssey and the Iliad get set as it changes into the writing.
We're talking to Gary Mex Glazner. Well, if a poem that is passed down through oral tradition changes a little bit each telling, each iteration, each generation, is it like the game of telephone where 20 generations later there's just no resemblance to the original?
You know what? This is so amazing. I hope people out there are loving this conversation, because to me, see, I've been working on this essay with Jane Hirschfield, reading it and extrapolating the information out to apply to the Alzheimer's Poetry Project. And it's almost like you've read the essay, because that's the next thing she talks about, is why doesn't it change like the game of telephone? Mm-hmm. And so she sees these parcels of information that, because they're rhymed and rhythmic, they get remembered exactly. So maybe the story changes a little bit, or the order, or it gets added to, but there's sections of it, chunks of it, that get passed down intact.
Exactly as they are.
And yeah, and when we see this a lot in proverbs or in Spanish-speaking culture as dichos.
Right.
And guess what? With the Alzheimer's population, that their first language is Spanish, one of the most effective tools to reach them in the late stages when their language skills are severely diminished is dichos.
Right.
You say a dicho and they immediately know it, and they know it exactly. You know, it's not an approximation.
And they're the equivalent of a stitch in time saves nine, or every cloud has a silver lining, things like that.
You know, I'm glad I'm sitting down. A stitch in time saves nine is the example that Jane Hirschfield uses in her essay.
Maybe we're channeling Jane Hirschfield here.
I
haven't read the essay.
Yeah.
That's very strange.
Yeah, so she uses that as the exact example, and it never gets, you know, a sort of a stitch, maybe eight. I mean,
right.
It always gets transmitted exactly as that language. And so that's what we see. And when you bring this work into the Alzheimer's facilities and into that community, if you say, quoth the raven, a percentage of the people will always say, nevermore.
What are the earliest poems that we have in the English language?
That goes back to Chaucer. And again, one of the things about poetry is, you know, often people will say, oh, I don't really know that many poems, or I don't know lines from poems or something. And it's so ingrained in us, going back to these older poems, that we often forget that they have their origins as poems. No Man Is an Island comes from a poem. Shakespeare is the champ of inventing phrases and stuff that enter the language, you know. And I consider his plays all, you know, basically poetry material.
And many of them are in meter. They're in iambic pentameter.
They're in meter. Love Letter is a great example from him that we, you know, everybody knows that phrase. It goes back to him, one of his lines. So it's kind of built into us this way of remembering things. And then, of course, as someone with a disease of Alzheimer's, it's the way to reach them. It's the way that you can warm them up and get them laughing and having a great time and playing with them. And that's what that project's about, is that moment where you're interacting rather than they're just sitting in the room or they're watching TV or, you know, any of the other kinds of activities that they engage in.
Let's talk about the relationship between music and poetry, because I imagine that a lot of, including Homer and so on, had a musical component to them, and the African stuff you were talking about.
Yeah, the griots always are singing it, and a lot of our, you know, really famous little kind of nursery rhyme, you know, that we think of as songs started their lives as poems. Yankee Doodle started its life as a poem. And again, I think it really is the rhymed rhythmic quality of it. And then when you add the melody to music that differentiates it from poetry, brings us to this great quote, because we're going to keep saying what different poets and different people think their definitions of poetry is. And Lorna D. Cervantes says, "I thought poems were for people with bad voices."
Oh.
So unsung songs.
Unsung
spoken
songs.
Spoken songs.
There, in terms of the memorization, it's almost terrifying to think about how much we actually have memorized. Not so much poems. I think a lot of people, I've probably memorized a very small handful of poems, but I know pretty much every song, every hit of the top 40, 70s when I was a little kid. And a friend and I actually stayed up way too late the other day reading websites with titles like Worst Songs of the 70s. And what was scary was, you know, not only every word, but every cadence, every nuance, every harmony of that stupid song that wasn't even worth listening to the first time, but you know them by heart.
Yeah, and often you will remember exactly where you were when you first heard it. You know, for me, I mean, there's a whole list of stuff like that, but you know, you'll hear something on the radio and suddenly you'll be back in your teenage bedroom, or you'll be, you know, at the junior high dance holding hands with someone or stepping on their feet, you know.
Or being humiliated by your peers, or...
Yeah.
So
I do think that that the Alzheimer's Poetry Project will shift, and there will be a time when the material will be Bob Dylan and the Grateful Dead, and then there will be a time when it's Snoop Doggy Dogg. That's what will work.
We're talking to Gary Mex Glazner, and by the way, he's going to be reading tonight at 7 o'clock at the Center for Contemporary Arts in Santa Fe, along with poet Adobe Gillis.
That's the band Adobe Gillis. That's Carlo Stanislefson and Milton Villarubius and Max Frieden something, the high man.
Friedenberg.
Yeah, well, he calls himself Frieden something. And they're the High Mayhem crew. And
right. Their band is Adobe Gillis.
Yeah, that's our band. I'm part of the band.
Okay.
But they're going to back me up. Milt plays drums, and Carlos plays bass. And then Max has a whole bunch of samples that he's created, including the last 2 days, every time we talk about what we're going to do at the show, he records the conversation and has made these sort of electronic music pieces out of them.
Oh,
So you'll start to hear those. And it's all set in the kind of a it's almost like a talk show format. We have a little theme that we play and stuff like that. So it's a lot of fun.
Let's hear some of your favorite poems.
Well, I wanted to start off with the poem Jabberwocky, and it's especially appropriate because my new book, How to Make a Life as a Poet, on Soft Skull Press, which is really about creative poetry programming and ways to make poetry of use to the community. I just wanted to have an experiment where I wanted to see if I could get a business to sponsor the introduction. And I found a lovely little bed and breakfast in Monterey, California, called the Jabberwocky Bed and Breakfast. And if you get the book and mention that they're the sponsors, you'll get a little bit off on your room there. It's right up from the Monterey Aquarium. It's just great, and all the rooms are Alice in Wonderland themed. So they sponsored the introduction, and this is Jabberwocky by Lewis Carroll. And then I think we're going to hear it in German. We're going to hear it in English first, and then German. 'Twas brillig, and the slithy toes did gyre and gimble in the wabe. All mimsy were the borogoves, and the mome raths outgrabe. Beware the Jabberwock, my son, the jaws that bite, the claws that catch. Beware the Jubjub bird, and shun the frumious Bandersnatch. He took his vorpal sword in hand, long time the maximal foe he sought. So rested he by the Tumtum tree, and stood a while in thought. And while in oofish thought he stood, the Jabberwock with eyes of flame came whipping through the doobly wood, and burbled as it came. 1, 2, 1, 2, and through and through and through and through. 1, 2, 1, 2, and through and through and through and through. The vorpal blade went snicker snack, he left it dead, and with its head he went galloping back. Has to slain the Jabberwock, oh come to mind, your fabulous boy. Callee, callee, he chortled in his joy. 'Twas brillig, and the slithy toads did gyre and gimble in the wabe. All mimsy were the borogoves, and the mome raths outgrabe.
Gary Mex Glazner, Jabberwocky by Lewis Carroll. Now, you took some liberties. You repeated some lines. You said some words different than the original.
Yeah, I play with the pronunciation. There is a guide to pronunciation in it. Because they're nonsense words, and so he lays them out, and I do a little repetition. And one of the funnest experiences I've ever had of performing the poem was in Monterey. And Monterey is a big military headquarters, and some of the Marines that were studying there had figured out that the best place to meet girls was at the poetry reading. So they came down and were hanging out at the poetry reading, and I got them to do the 1, 2, 1, 2 with me in their military chant, and they started pounding the table and just really getting into it. It was a great experience.
Do you want to hear it in German?
Let's hear it in German.
Der Jammerwoch is what it's called. Es brillig war, die schlichte Toven wirrten und wimmelten im Waben und aller mümsiger Burgoven, die Mome reit aus Graben. Bewahre doch vor Jammerwoch, die Zähne knirschen, krallen, kratzen, bewahr vor Jubjubvogel und frumiöse Banderschnatzen. Er griff sein Vorpasschwerten zu, er suchte lang das manchsam Ding, dann stehend unterm Tumtumbaum er anzudenken fing. Als stand er tief in Andacht auf der Jammerwochens Augenfeuer, durch Turgenwald mit Wiffig kam und burbelnd ungeheuer. 1, 2, 1, 2 und durch sein Worpelschwert zerschnüffeschnück. Da blieb er tot und Kopf in Hand, geläumpfig zog zurück. Und schlugst du ja den Jammerwoch? Umarme mich, mein böhmisches Kind. O Freudentag, o Halluschlag, er schortelt frohgesinnt. Es brillig war, die schlichte Toven wirrten und wimmelten im Waben und aller mümsige Burgoven, die Momenred ausgraben.
Oh, that's great.
you've heard that. There's a French
version,
too.
No, I've never heard the German version.
Really?
No.
It's in the annotated Alice.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's great. There was a German film crew that came through New York recently doing a documentary on the Poetry Slam, and they had been interviewing people at pretty traditional, you know, coffee houses and bars and things like that, and they asked if I had any unusual places where they could interview me, and I said, well, why don't we do it on the Brooklyn Bridge? And so I got my bike and we met on the Brooklyn Bridge, and I did Jabberwocky for them because I thought it would be one of the poems that really would work, you know, for the German audience. And it was just really fun riding around on the bridge and zooming past them and going in circles, and they would just have the camera, and so it was really fun.
It's an odd poem because it's full of nonsense words, and on some level it doesn't really mean that much of anything. You can sort of get a narrative from it, but what makes it a poem? I mean, it certainly doesn't necessarily take you by the throat or chop the top of your head off.
Yeah, and yet it actually does chop somebody's head off at the end.
Well, that's
I mean, it
true.
Really does chop someone's head off. It's an interesting one to use with kids and with seniors with dementia. It is very playful. And for me, it's a perfect vehicle for the idea of sound poetry, and allows the use of the text to have this sort of performative quality. And that's why I love it so much. But it is very musical, too. And I loved some of the German translations. It was really
incredible. It's very funny. If you know German, it's even funnier, because it's also sort of made up and twisted up German.
Yeah.
Is Dr. Seuss poetry?
I think it is. I think it's Dr. Seuss is really a great poet. And I think, I use mostly classic poems in the Alzheimer's Project, but I think Dr. Seuss is a great, great way to reach people too. I mean, they really respond to it. And it's a great, I was working in Santa Fe in a class that was mostly Spanish speaking, and we translated a little bit of Verde Huevos y Jamón.
Green eggs and ham.
Yeah.
And the best reading of that was when Dr. Seuss died, the Reverend Jesse Jackson did a reading of that preacher style of Green Eggs and Ham on Saturday Night Live.
Oh,
it was the greatest tribute to the man that I've ever seen.
Yeah, that's sweet.
We're talking to Gary Mex-Glazner. Now, a lot of, historically, a lot of poetry, and certainly the poems that you were forced to read in high school, which is probably a lot of people's only exposure to poetry, are in very strict meters and rhyme schemes. What does that give you? What does that give the reader and the writer of poetry?
Well, as a writer, if you're working in a traditional form, what it does is it sort of puts these limits, and so you have to then be creative to get into that. I think a lot of the reason that people dropped writing in rhyme was it does sort of lead to cliches, because most of the June spoon moon rhymes have been
love
used up.
Heaven above.
Yeah, but there's some really wonderful forms out there that you can work in that don't necessarily have to rhyme, but it does give you some repetition, which is a great one of the great poetry techniques. I really like Pantoums, which has a pretty complicated rhyme scheme. But
do you have one to read?
Oh, that would have been great, wouldn't it have been? I don't have a Pantoum off the top of my head. So that maybe I shouldn't have brought that up.
That's okay.
Robert Frost, another poetry definition, says writing free verse is like playing tennis with the net down. So it sort of gives a kind of structure and rules to it. And kids, of course, we look back, to sort of what people call a golden time in poetry, which is the Romantic period, which a lot of the classic poems come out of that I use in the Alzheimer's Poetry Project. But now with hip-hop and young people being interested in hip-hop, thousands and thousands of kids around the country are writing in rhymed rhythmic poetry again.
And very creatively.
Very creatively, and coming up with incredible rhyme schemes. New rhymes that you don't really think of.
Hip-hop has really taken over a lot of spoken poetry today, in poetry slams and in poetry readings and stuff. And sometimes I wonder if it hasn't sort of taken over too much, because it's a certain style, it's a certain kind of hard-hitting emotional feeling, but it's not appropriate for a lot of the emotions that are to be expressed, and indeed for a lot of the poems that are to be read. I mean, people read you guys, didn't you read some Blake in hip-hop style?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, with a performance style, Tiger, Tiger, burning bright in the forest of the night, Tiger, Tiger, burning bright in la bosque de la noche, that kind of flipped rhythm. And it is a way for a teaching tool, where you can then expose the students to a really classic poem with some, great images and lines and inspire them.
Because it connects to something they already know.
Yeah, it connects. You give them a way to perform it, and they learn it, and they start to like it before they realize they're really studying. You don't start with the idea of analyzing the poem and trying to figure out, what in thy furnace, in what furnace was thy brain means. So it's a great teaching tool. And one of the things that's interesting for me when I think about hip hop is that it's not part of the academic poetry world. It's not necessarily.
Well, it is now.
Well, kind of,
there are professors of cultural studies who study hip hop and write books and PhDs. And
yeah, it's making its way in for sure. But if you look at, like, for instance, there's a conference that happens every year called Associated Writing Programs. That's all the writing teachers from around the country. They all gather, and there's thousands of them. Out of all the panels, there'll be maybe one or two will be on hip hop. But sort of urban poetry or spoken word, but the bulk of it is not. And I often think that the poem that's appropriate for a 16-year-old, and that they respond to, and that they write, and that tells the story of their community and what's going on in their life, is probably not the same poem for me as a 50-year-old. But in working with the kids, you see they're incredibly creative, and the poems are well written. I'm just working with a group of kids from Urban Word NYC, which is a outreach program in New York, and we performed at the public library and at the Lincoln Center Outdoors Festival, and their writing is great. Now, it doesn't necessarily speak to my life experience, but it shouldn't. You know what I mean? Why should a 16-year-old from the Bronx be writing a poem, or why should I, as a 50-year-old overweight white guy, write a poem that reaches him? I mean, I think that's the great thing about poetry. There's enough room and enough, big tent, as they say. Here's another poetry quote.
But also, I mean, if it's really good, it can be universal.
Yeah, it can. And then you just sort of have to break down the stereotypes. And there's a lot of sort of barriers and where people think they know what's going on in the other camp, the academic world versus spoken word versus hip hop. But when you sit down, you see more. More connections and more love of language. That's a central thing for all of those communities. John F. Kennedy says, "When power narrows the areas of man's concern, poetry reminds him of the richness and diversity of his existence. When power corrupts, poetry cleanses."
There we have it, John F. Kennedy. Let's read some more. Let's have you read some more poems.
Yeah, I'll do. This poem is by the poet laureate of New Zealand, a guy named Hani Tufari, and it's a poem called Rain. "I can hear you making small holes in the silence, rain, and if I were deaf, my pores would open to you and shut, and I should know you by the lick of you if I were blind. The something special smell when you sun-cake the ground, the steady drum roll you make when the wind drops. But if I should not hear, see, smell, or taste you, you would still define me, disperse me, wash over me, rain." Now, the way I use that in a setting with kids, and I got a great response to this poem in the juvenile lockdown facility in Tucson, Arizona, which was a group of teenage kids who had done fairly substantial crimes. And I did the poem with them, and then I did the little sign where you put your fingers together and your thumb together, and you start to do that little motion that leads you to sing, "Itsy
Bitsy, Bitsy Spider.
Spider." And I did the poem Rain, and then as soon as I did that motion to them, these tough, hardened kids all broke into Itsy Bitsy Spider. And it was very sweet.
Wow.
And then what I did next with that group, I'm going to just give you different examples of how poetry can be of use to the community, how it can work. I did E.E. Cummings' poem, "Anyone Lived in a Pretty How Town," as a square dance, and I got the kids up and they square danced to it. And the guards, as we were leaving after the session was over, they said, "You should have bet us that you could have gotten those kids up to square dance." Because they didn't believe it. So here's "Anyone Lived in a Pretty How Town," as if E.E. Cummings wrote square dances. Anyone lived in a pretty hot town, up so floating, many bells down. Spring, summer, autumn, winter, he sang his didn't any dance this did. Women and men, both little and small, cared for anyone not at all. Reaped their sowing, went there came, sun, moon, stars, rain. Children guessed, but only a few, down they forgot as up they grew. Autumn, winter, spring, summer, no one loved them more by more. Wind by now, tree by leaf, she laughed his joy, she cried his grief. Bird by snow, stir by still, anyone lived in a pretty hot town, up so floating, many bells down. Men, women. It was sort of not a square dance ending there.
No, I should say. But that's amazing. E.E. Cummings was playing tennis without a net.
Yeah, he definitely was playing tennis without a net. Yeah. And he actually, when you hear him, they have recordings of him reading that poem, and he does sort of chant it. He does give a little chant feeling to it.
We're talking to Gary Max Glazner, who will be performing tonight along with Adobe Gillis at 7 o'clock at the Center for Contemporary Arts here in Santa Fe, which is right on Old Pecos Trail. Emily Dickinson is a poet who's... this will probably ruin it for many listeners, but a lot of her poems can be sung to the tune of The Yellow Rose of Texas, and I'd Like to Buy the World a Coke.
Yeah, right, that's right.
You put that aside, the musical part of it aside, which is kind of sick, but what makes her poetry so great? I go back to it, and I'm not that much of a poetry reader, but I go back to it, and I even sometimes memorize them just because there's something there that's so deep, but I can't put my finger on it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting thing with her. Sherman Alexie brings out the point that when Emily, people don't know the story, she was sort of reclusive, and she lived in Massachusetts, a reclusive in Massachusetts, with her family.
Don't use that rhyme.
And, please, danger. And it sort of shut herself off, but created this incredibly complex and rich world through her poems. Didn't publish much, if maybe a couple in her lifetime, and her sisters collected the work. Or she had sort of put it into little pamphlet forms and stored it all away. I think maybe 1,000 or 2,000 poems that she had written. But Sherman Alexie brings up the point that while she was doing that, and in this room and. It was the same time of Sitting Bull and Custer. And I think that's a remarkable thing to think about as far as historically. And at the Bowery Poetry Club, which I'm the managing director of in New York City, we have our bathrooms are, instead of men and women, they are Emily and Walt, for Emily Dickinson and Walt Whitman. And you would think in a poetry club people would just get that, but they don't. And I don't know, we may have to do something about it, because we constantly get, people will walk down into the bathroom area and they will stop and stare at the doors. And they won't go in, and it's, one says Emily, and they'll just look at it, and then they'll ask,
They'll think it's somebody's office?
They haven't ever encountered a door that has Emily written on it, I guess.
Are there any of her poems that you'd like to read?
I can't really do the whole poem, but one I use a lot in the Alzheimer's Project is I'm Nobody, Who Are You? Are you nobody too? Then there's a pair of us, Don't Tell. And then she goes on to, do this sort of frog images, living the long day in the bog. And it's a great, great poem to use with kids and get them to do the frog sounds. And it's really fun.
There's one that I memorized. I wonder if I've got it correctly. It's very short. It goes, the heart seeks pleasure first, and then excuse from pain, and then those little anodynes that deaden suffering, and then to go to sleep, and then if it should be the will of its inquisitor, the privilege to die.
Oh, that's great.
I know. It's pretty heavy duty.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
About, this was something that always drove me crazy when I was a teenager and we had to read poems. Poems that are not understandable unless you know the secret of decoding them.
Yeah, and that it's a problem in education, you know, that poems do get seen as these sort of puzzles that you have to kind of figure out, and it gets very complicated for people. And then there's a whole sort of poetry movement or genre called language poetry that gets, you know, really code-like. And then that kind of comes out of the T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound modernist movement,
for
too.
For example.
Yeah, when poems got, you know, really, really difficult to understand for the average person.
It was sort of like they put them into cipher, and then you had to get the tools to decipher them. And you find yourself, at least as a young person, but probably if I read them now, I'd feel the same way. Thinking, why didn't they just say it in the first place?
Yeah, exactly. You know, and what's the, what, why do you need to have a sort of a, you know, score chart of ancient terms and things to be able to figure it out? And I guess one of the things for me of poetry is that, you know, just the sound of it is pleasing, and that can be enough, you know, that you don't have to think that you have to understand exactly what it is, or maybe through a repeated exposure to it, you sort of get some kind of meaning. But I don't, I mean, maybe that's a weakness, but I don't spend that much time trying to analyze them. But I do love the musicality of poetry and the sounds. And
are poems always meant to be heard?
I think they are, yeah. I think they're not completed until they're heard. I think that there's a part where the poet speaks them and it goes to the listener's ear, and those little, you know, anvil and stirrup things inside there get excited, and it makes those connections in the you know, central nervous system and the brain, and the synapses start firing and the neurotransmitters start racing. And that's
so that's the relationship that you were talking about between poetry and the brain. It's very natural to us in some way.
Yeah. And again, you know, to go back to this idea of that it's the start of the way that that our brain is built around being able to memorize things. You know, it just is incredibly powerful if you take that tack and think about it that way.
We're talking to Gary Mex Glazner. Well, in, you know, the modern world, poetry no longer serves, for most people, the function of being the history of your people and so on. What is the utility of poetry now? I mean, one example from the movie Il Postino is getting somebody to fall in love with you.
Yeah, I did a workshop yesterday morning, Tuesday morning in New York for the Outward Bound program, who normally takes kids into the wilderness, but they have a urban Outward Bound where kids come into New York City, and they actually carry these huge backpacks, but they walk around and they see things, and they had arranged for me to do a poetry workshop with them, so it would give them some tools as they went through the city this week, for a way to experience it and a way to understand it and to write their own experience about it. And one of the things that and this group of teenagers from Florida, and that was the, you know, point that they really responded to, is like, okay, so we're talking about recitation skills and public speaking, and we're talking about being able to express your emotions. Well, one of the great uses of being able to be a clear, passionate public speaker is to be able to woo someone, you know. And so, yeah, you know, if you're thinking like, if I know how to articulate and to project and, you know, and bring out the emotional content of my poem or my speech, and then that leads to me getting a date, well, that's a great thing.
Are limericks poems?
Yeah, I think limericks are definitely poems.
That's the only kind I can write, but I think it's a very, very low form.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a, yeah, and they often are very raunchy, you know, so.
So, what makes, I mean, this is something I know you can't answer, but there's a lot of bad poetry out there. What makes a poem bad?
Yeah, I mean, maybe I'm an expert on that. You know,
because you see so much student work and you just
no,
because
I write
teaching.
So much bad poetry. I guess part of it's personal taste of, you know, where's the line that makes it bad. And, you know, certainly the way there's a huge controversy in the poetry world about should poems be performed? Is the written page the, you know, the place where the art happens, or is it also in the recitation? And, you know, for me, it is in the recitation. But and again, to going back to this idea that the poem that's bad for a 16-year-old is probably not the same that's bad for a 50-year-old, is not the same that's bad for a 70-year-old, or that's good, you know, the one that reaches you and makes you want to write your own poem, or you know, lets you see some element of being human that has you be able to better understand your life and your place in the world. These probably aren't the same poems for everybody. And, you know, like... you know, what's a bad angle for a carpenter, you know, and like me, a beginner carpenter, I might think the way I nail these two boards is just great, but you get somebody who's a master carver, carpenter, you know, who can do excellent work, and that wouldn't suffice. You know, I think that's the same with poetry too. As you explore it and learn more about it, your idea of what, you know, moves you changes. And you realize how much you don't know, and that's part of it. Let's go back to one of these quotes. This one's Mark Twain. It's not specifically about poetry, but it addresses word choice. He says, "The difference between the right and nearly right word is the same as that between lightning and the lightning bug." So that's
very good.
Yeah. And then Robert Graves says, "There's no money in poetry, but then there's no poetry in money either." And Coleridge says, "Poetry, the best words in the best order." So those are...
So for you, being a poet and being a teacher and working with so many different kinds of people, how do you keep your own mind free? How do you keep your spirit free?
Well, you know, I was a florist for 18 years, but I always wanted to do something more masculine, so I became a poet. But, you know, really, for me, being able to do this shift where my central life and central ability to, you know, to make a living from poetry becomes the, you know, the main part of my life, not having a second job. It allows you to then, you know, use your own work in the classroom. And then very, a wonderful aspect of it is it allows you to use your experiences in working in the communities to inform your poetry or to, you know, to you write about it. So like, for instance, with the working with Alzheimer's, I have a whole series of poems I'm working on. And this is one of them. It's written in the voices of some of the people I work with. It's called "We Are Forget." We are the words we have forgotten. We are shifting and pacing. We wrote this poem. It's a pretty poem. Can you bake a cherry pie? Nevermore. Nevermore. We have no horizon. We don't call washing or eating or what you just said. Ask me my name. Ask me if I have children. You are my daughter, light washing over us. You're a handsome man. You're a beautiful woman. You have lovely eyes. We don't recall washing or eating or what you just said. Our handwriting is beautiful, twists and loops of letters. We can't remember our hands. Our ears are wishful. Can't remember our ears. We speak every language. We can't remember our mouths. We're the past. We are porous. We are forget."
Gary Max Glazner.
So in that case, you know, it directly... I would never have written that poem without being in that community and working with people who are living with Alzheimer's disease. And
I would think a poem like that would speak very much to the relatives of the people who have Alzheimer's as well.
Yeah, it does. And I think one of the most devastating things for the family is when they're not recognized. And we just had the big story about Sandra Day O'Connor's husband has Alzheimer's, and he's in Arizona. It just came out about a week or so ago, and this is a fairly common phenomenon in that world. He has got a girlfriend at the assisted living center that he lives in, and they are very much in love, and the Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor really supports it, and you know, when you see that, I mean, the only thing you can do for them at that point in the late stage of the disease is that each moment is as enjoyable as possible. And so even though, how heartbreaking to see your husband no longer recognizes you, no longer understands that you are his wife, and yet you see the happiness that he's been able to find with another person who's in a similar mental state.
We have about a little less than 6 minutes left. Would you like to read another poem?
Yeah, this one I'd like to read. This is a sort of a prose poem.
It's funny because every poem I've asked you to read, you've just recited. I want our listeners to know that.
Yeah.
Now for the first time, you're actually opening a book.
Yeah, so this one's called Taking a Rock for Poetry. And it starts off with the Emily Dickinson quote.
This is by you?
Yeah, this is my, it's an essay, really. A poetry essay. Taking a rock for poetry. If I feel physically as if the top of my head were taken off, I know that is poetry. Emily Dickinson. The rock hit the back of my head, and I turned and saw a blur of kids careening away. Not Palestinians with their furious windups challenging tanks, but American kids unable to pass a class with the stuck-in-summer-school blues again. What was I to these kids? Obviously, I was an authority figure with a bullseye saying, school me. Their weapon of choice went thump, and I thought, white flag, cock-a-doodle-doo, my, these stars are pretty. I wanted to be a superhero poet. Yes, I fantasized about helping these underserved, at-risk, cherub monsters we call kids, racing to rescue with rhythm and rhyme, cape flapping, leaping tall metaphors with a single bound. The poet who reached these 7th and 8th graders who had all flunked at least two classes. The poet who put his hand on their gelled heads and raised their reading level, shouting, can you feel the power of poetry, child? Hey, mister, save us. Use your superpowers for good of all humans. Teach us how to spell and pronounce alliteration and hyperbole and what they mean and how they will lead to good jobs and white picket fence pensions and that sweet old American dream. Right all wrongs, man of P, poet man. The thump hurt, but was too quick to be scary. I flashed back to the day before when the student sitting at his desk, shaking with rage, a little hormonal earthquake. When I asked him why he was fuming, he rumbled, face hot, unable to speak, as if he might explode and shoot around the room like a pop balloon. Take a walk. Go get a drink, I said. He seemed better when he came back to class, no longer shaking uncontrollably. What was scary was as the class ended, one of the students, the angry kid, I couldn't be sure, said, you are looking for Columbine. I brushed it off until the morning when I sprung up in my bed thinking, alarm bell, danger, danger, Columbine, I should tell somebody. I woke the school with my crowing, and soon I was sitting in a conference room with the principal, the school therapist, and the student. We talked about his rage. A girl had spit water in his face. We talked about dealing with anger. We only had to go back to the previous day to find an example of a kid shooting people to death in a rage over being abused. The principal said, tell us what you heard, Gary. You're looking for Columbine, I said. I think I heard you say that as you were leaving. What? He said. I never said that. I don't even know what Columbine is. What's Columbine? The therapist said, you've never heard of Columbine? No, he said. You've never seen the movie Bowling for Columbine? No. You don't know about the students who shot other students and then killed themselves? No. I would never shoot anybody. Later it came out that the boy's father had been reported to the state youth and family services for beating him and that the father had an extensive gun collection. Gun dad, gun nut beats boy is what I was thinking when I saw the rock settling, his face blank, his voice flat, denying having heard the buzzword for school violence. How chilling the denial. Now all I wanted to do was get out of there before they hurt me or I hurt them. It was the last day of summer school, and no one had been kicked out, and they would not have to repeat a grade, and there's some small victory in that, something worth a 3-hour headache and being known forever as Poet Rock Noggin. One of the things we love about poets is their tragic death. This wasn't Lorca and a fascist firing squad, nor Plath's Easy Bake Oven, or Hart Crane's swan diving off an ocean liner. This was just a double flunker with a good arm and an eye, teaching me my lesson of life. Don't think for a moment your fancy pants poetry can do us any good. What we want most from you is to steal this sting of how smart we are and to go now. I give myself an F. I figured out why these kids acted out, refused to read aloud or write on the board. They're embarrassed by not reading and writing well. Their brilliant strategy, a constant whirl of clowning, fighting, and selling whining, keeping the teacher and the other students from knowing how poorly skilled they are. They were furious when I made them read Green Eggs and Ham. That's for little kids, they said, but the Spanish-speaking students loved translating it into Verde, Huevo, Cinnamon. And in the end, I, like all their other teachers, passed them and their problems on, an assembly line of semi-blank minds speeding out of control. If it had been a bullet, people would have said he died for his art. Perhaps the students were right. I never liked poetry either. What a great poet's death it would have been. Man murdered by poetry-hating mob. Instead, only my pride died. And the headline reads, Poet Punked by Rock.
Gary Meggs Glazner, thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Thanks, Santa Fe.
And Gary will be tonight at the CCA, the Center for Contemporary Arts, at 1050 Old Pecos Trail. You can see ccasantafe.org or 982-1338 for more information. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan features Artist of the Month, Herbie Hancock. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Hasta la vista. Ciao.